Session number 10693, Reel 5.
Colonel Norman, Reel 5. You were saying that in Bombay you never got invited to anywhere except for the governor's palace for the annual ball.
Well, there was one other house I went into. It was the flat of a South African civilian who belonged to the Territorial Army, or equivalent, and he was attached to us for training, and he asked us into his, or some of us, into his flat, I think on one occasion. That's the only time. Actually, I met him later on in the war in Cairo. They didn't really recognise soldiers in Bombay. I believe it's quite different elsewhere, especially in Calcutta. But we weren't even allowed to be honorary members of the yacht club until about 3 months before we left India. And that was very nice when we were allowed in.
Did you get involved in any other active operations before leaving India?
No.
So it was training in Doolally and then a bit of internal security in Bombay.
Yes. TEWTS, tactical exercises without troops, of course, went on always, wherever you were.
This was just to keep your tactical skills up to scratch?
Yes. It was the usual sort of officer's training.
Who conducted those?
Well, it depended what level it was, really. Possibly it might be the CO himself, or someone who was especially good at it, like my own company commander, who was pretty good on tactical exercises. And of course, sometimes they were internal security, sometimes they were tactics, ordinary field tactics. We used to have debates occasionally too, on all sorts of things. And on the promotion system, I think we had a debate once, and I was deputed to speak against it, although I wasn't. But that sort of training we had. And also, there was a certain amount of law, too. I had to defend two men in a court-martial up in Doolally, and I'd never even attended a court-martial. You're supposed to have gone twice as an observer before you were ever deputed to do an actual job. Well, there wasn't anybody, so they had to give it to me to do. And quite fortuitously, really, I think, they got very light sentences. And so after that, people used to ask for me to defend them, which is a frightful curse. I did a most terrible long trial in Tientsin. Later on, two chaps charged with rape, and the case took a very, very long time, and I got them off. it was got to the stage where I was invited to defend people on one occasion, a man in another regiment. Then, of course, I became adjutant, and I had to do all the prosecutions, which is a different matter altogether.
Well, what had the two men done, the two first men you defended?
Peeping Tom, as far as I can remember, conduct the prejudice of good order and military discipline, Section 4 of the Army Act. They were doing a Peeping Tom Act, I believe, on some woman who was believed to have a bit of a reputation. Sounds pretty trivial now, but I took it very seriously. I didn't know anything about military law much. I had studied it at Cambridge when I did that special course on military studies, but I'd never been to a court-martial. Anyway, they got off, or practically got off.
When you went on TEWTS, were they done with elaborate preparation, with paperwork and so forth in advance, or were they done on an improvised basis in the field?
I think they were mostly done indoors with sand tables. Fairly elaborate sand tables. But there were outdoor ones as well. I had to conduct some myself much later on, actually, after the war, when I was second in command.
And did you devise those yourself? Or?
Oh, yes. Luckily, I'd been on a course at Warminster before I ever really had to do anything important. The company commander's course at Warminster was very, very good stuff, I always thought, especially for me, who'd done an awful lot of on the staff, and we really got terribly out of date about real soldiering. And Warminster was marvellous. I didn't enjoy it very much because the conditions were pretty terrible just after the war, or fairly soon after the war.
So you would devise a scenario from first principles and then...
I suppose so, yes. But this, remember, I was only a subaltern before the war. I didn't become an acting captain until 1940, so I was jolly unimportant. And when I became an acting captain, it's when I became adjutant.
What sort of scale would these toots go up to?
I can't remember much about it before the war, but I can remember after the war in Germany, when they were run by the brigade commander for anybody who was in the brigade. And I would have been a major then, probably for majors and captains.
And you would all have been given appointments in a...
Yes, yes. You're given a problem and say, you are OC1 DLI, and this is the situation, this is what you've got to do. How are you going to set about it? O groups and so on. That's another thing we had to do, of course, before the war, was promotion exams. Horrible that was. Had to study for your promotion exam. Quite hard, too.
Did you have instruction, or was it done by correspondence? Or by
the promotion exam?
Yes.
No instruction whatsoever within the battalion. I think you were just examining what you knew, but the written part was very tricky. For some reason or other, I can't remember why, I was given the American Civil War, and I didn't do a correspondence course, but I studied it when I was on the way back from Shanghai to England with another chap. We were both sent home to do courses. He was doing a PT course and I was doing an education course, and he had the Metropolitan correspondence course, but he wasn't doing the American Civil War, so I had to study that myself. And I had the books, which I thought were awfully boring, and it wasn't until I'd saw Gone with the Wind and read that book that the thing really began to sink in at all. And then I was quite interested, and actually latterly very much more interested, because I've come into contact with a whole lot of American relations whose ancestor left England in 1723, and they're all over Virginia and all over the Civil War area. And so that part of that history has really become alive for me, and I'm quite interested in it even now.
Do you remember any of the textbooks that you had
to
read?
No, I don't. But there certainly was one very good one.
What impression did it make on the battalion when they were told they were going off to Khartoum?
I think it was probably well known before I even got there.
So it had a long warning.
Oh, yes. I mean, yes, I'm pretty sure. You see, they only did about 2 years in Bombay. They came from Calcutta and Lebong, where I think they'd been some time. And then the idea was to sort of gradually smooth your way out of India by doing 2 years in Bombay and then 1 year in Khartoum and then home, because Khartoum was a non-family station and you couldn't keep them there indefinitely. The Black Watch of the other battalion in Khartoum, they had a company in Cyprus, would you believe it? Another thing that happened in 1936, of course, which stirred us enormously, was the abdication. None of us had the slightest idea there was such a person as Mrs. Simpson, really, out there, because you didn't get much in the way of news. I suppose we cursorily examined the Times of India every day, probably, and that was about it. And this came as a terrific shock, especially as we'd had one proclamation parade already that year. We then had to have another one for the new king.
How did the men take that?
I think it was the whole battalion was in a state of shock.
What's the feeling in the battalion for the king or against the king?
I don't know. My feelings were against, I must admit. The usual thing, I think everybody, chaps like us, was simply, we let the side down. That's the sort of attitude, I think.
You mentioned that you couldn't take families to Khartoum. Were the families out in India with the battalion?
Oh, yes. We had two people who weren't getting marriage allowance. I'm talking about officers. Married underage, and so they got no allowances. And the CO didn't have his wife out, nor did the acting CO before him. I don't know why, a personal matter, I think. But there were several other wives, and that's the only hospitality we ever got outside the mess.
What was there for them to do during the day?
Goodness knows. Look after their children, I think, that's all. And not much of that, because they all had Indian servants.
How did you actually get to the Sudan?
We went in a troop ship called the Lancashire. I was acting as assistant adjutant to Nigel Poet, now General Sir Nigel Poet. And he was the adjutant. He only had two stars, and I had two stars, but there was quite a difference between us, in fact, a very large difference. And he was... I had all the nasty sort of administrative jobs to deal with, like getting the battalion through the customs in Sudan, Port Sudan. I had to stay behind in Port Sudan for about 3 days while the battalion went off, and I had to see everything through the customs, even to the remotest detail, like bundles of polo sticks. And anybody who had a shotgun had to pay duty on it, and they were supposed to get a refund when they left the country. But of course, you go into Khartoum by Port Sudan and you leave through Egypt. It's not easy to get your money back. Nobody ever did, I don't think. I know I didn't.
What other sorts of things were dutiable?
I don't know. I don't think we ever paid any duty at all on anything, but it all had to be vetted. I can't remember paying any duty on anything. The whole thing was frightfully boring. The only decent thing that happened while I was at Port Sudan was being taken for a ride in one of those glass-bottomed boats in the Red Sea and seeing all the wonderful scenery underneath the boat. That's all I can remember about it.
How long did the voyage take?
No idea.
Was it reasonably comfortable?
Well, it wouldn't have been comfortable for the troops, but they never were in those days, hideously uncomfortable. The officers fared much better. You probably shared a cabin with two or three other officers at my rank. The food was always very good, very elaborate, with the Gurney's staff, who were absolutely terrific on... But you probably get about 20 different dishes offered for breakfast. The laundry arrangements were very good too, always on troop ships, because of these Guyanese chaps.
What were your first impressions then of the Sudan, apart from the customs?
Rather favourable. I felt awfully fit the whole time I was there. It was very pleasant in the sort of winter. We got there in January, I think it was, might have been February. And it was still nice and cool in the early morning, very refreshing and lovely. And then, of course, it got absolutely raging hot. And we used to start frightfully early in the morning, possibly so getting on to the rifle range at perhaps even 5 o'clock. And you shot until you got a haze which blotted out the targets or started them shaking about you in the mirage. And then the rest of the day was sort of possibly on the square drill, and usually ending up with a swim at about 12 o'clock in the battalion swimming pool, and then bed, afternoon, and then polo in the evening. That was the sort of routine.
Were you accommodated actually in the city of Khartoum?
We were not in the native city, no, on the outskirts of the native city. Of course, the biggest city part of Khartoum is Omdurman, which is the other side of the Blue Nile? No, the White Nile. I can't remember which is which. And we were on the edge of the other river, quite near Government House. The governor used to give a reception or a levee. I think they called it a levee every so often, and very early in the morning, about 8 o'clock. And so you get up in your smartest khaki drill, beautifully ironed and starched, and we used to go down in a launch, standing up so as not to crease our uniforms. Like, I remember the first time I went on one of these dues, the English regiments went in first, and all the Arab notables used to turn up carrying swords and looking frightfully smart, but we went in first. Well, actually after the Black Watch, because they were a senior regiment to us, and shook hands with the Governor General, and then went out into the garden where there were long tables with tablecloths on and glasses and beer, draft beer, in huge jugs. And gosh, I was thirsty by the time I got there, and I downed one of these glasses of beer before I realised it was Coca-Cola. It was the only time I've ever drunk Coca-Cola, and I hope I never have to do it again. It was revolting. But that's the sort of thing we did about once a quarter in Khartoum, I think.
Apart from shooting until it got too hazy and so on, and drilling, what other sort of training could you do there? Was there a lot of tactical
training? Oh, yes. I can't remember much about it.
Did it differ, in essence, from what you've been doing at Dulele?
I don't think so, no. I think it was all the same sort of thing. I had to run an anti-gas course. Yes, because when I was in India, I did a week or a fortnight up at Mau, where they did anti-gas training. And so the CO deputed me to do a little bit of anti-gas work for the battalion. It was pretty pathetic, I think. He was mad keen on fishing. He was a great trout and salmon fisherman. And he started a fishing club for all ranks, and he taught them how to cast flies and all the rest of it. And nearby there was a dam over the Nile, a place called Jebel Aliyah. And I can remember having to go there one day. I think it was on a bank holiday, not that that made any difference. Take my platoon a batch of rather keen fishermen. Amateurs, fishermen of all ranks, while they fished for these Nile perch, which went up to about 10 or 14 stone. They were huge things, quite inedible too, and spent all day there trying to keep under the shade while these chaps fished and produced these revolting fish, which we had to bring back tied to the outside of the lorry. And the driver got sunstroke on this occasion, and was absolutely no idea where he was at all. And there was absolutely nothing at all but sand.
How did you navigate in?
Well, I navigated by the sun. I thought, well, if we drive wherever it is, north, I think it was on this occasion, we're bound to hit something in the way of civilization. And sure enough, after quite some time. Mild panic. We hit a line of telegraph poles, so that was all right.
Did you have good maps in Sudan?
No. Don't think you did, because it was rather like the Western Desert. So the Western Desert, you had the sea on one side and the escarpment on the other, and you knew pretty well that provided you went in one direction, you'd be all right in the end. But I found navigation in the Western Desert absolutely hellish. The multiplicity of tracks, everybody trying to avoid the vehicle in front because of the sand dust coming up. And so there'd be a half a mile of parallel tracks. In the cartoon, we did practically nothing in vehicles at all, as far as I can remember.
What happened to these fish that had been caught?
I can't remember.
If they weren't eaten, did they just...
I think they did try eating them, but everybody disliked them so much that no one tried anymore. I used to take my platoon out on holidays or recreation days, in boats sometimes, and shoot at crocodiles. And later on, we had a detachment at a place called Gobait in the Red Sea Hills. I suppose it's about halfway to Port Sudan, but I can't remember exactly. And that was a sort of R&R place. We worked on alternate days, sort of mild training on alternate days. And the other days were recreational, and one tried to sort of organise all sorts of things for them. We had the band down there, which made a great difference. And we used a disused turntable for railway engines as a swimming bath. And we had competitions there. I damn near drowned, actually. I was laughing so much one day on an obstacle race. You had to swim across the thing and pick up with your mouth a bun and then swim back with it. And I damn near drowned. I was laughing so much. Barn and water going in. I took some chaps up shooting ibex up in the hills, but you're only allowed to shoot two ibex, and I didn't know that, and shot my two the first day. But then I used to take other people up. That was fun. We shared the place in Gobait with the Black Watch. They had I think two companies or more there, and the commandant was a major in the Black Watch, who afterwards became Sir Neil Ritchie. And we used to play three-a-side polo on the old airfield, which wasn't easy, actually, because it was pretty soft going and the ball kept on just disappearing into a hole, and you had to stop everything and get off and dig it out. He had a pony, I remember, which bit me when I was riding it off, and so I clunked him one on the nose with my mallet. And old Ritchie insisted on stopping the game and declaring a foul against me. There was no referee or anything like that, so he got his foul because he was a brevet major and I was only a subaltern. I never forgot that. You're not allowed to bring a pony on the field that bites.
How did you get on with the Black Watch?
Very well indeed. I got to know the Black Watch quite a lot during the whole of my service, not only before the war but after as well. We were stationed alongside many times: Berlin, Iserlohn, Dortmund, Korea, Khartoum, and probably otherwise as well. And I knew one or two of them before. I knew Bernard Ferguson, for instance, quite well until he died. I was an umpire to his battalion once after the war, and I got him killed. He never forgave me for that. He moved off his battalion in the middle of the night without telling me, and not even leaving a message. I had to find him.
How did the Black Watch compare to the Durhams? Were the levels of training about the same?
I think so, yeah. We never trained together, that I can remember, before the war in Khartoum. We were quite separate. They were the other side of the river, for a start. I was in a concert party and I took them over to the Black Watch to perform. Otherwise, we didn't see each other except socially. I was always very sorry for the Black Watch. Had to wear kilts in the middle of hot weather in Khartoum. They must have suffered agonies with that sort of thick, heavy stuff round the waist with prickly heat. Of course, they insisted on wearing this ridiculous uniform.
What was your own uniform like in Khartoum? Was it the same as it had been in India?
Oh, yes. Exactly the same, as far as I can remember. Of course, in those days, you know, right until the first year of the war, one wore a topi, always, in the daylight. Even to go to the mess, one put on a topi. The only time you didn't wear one was when you were swimming, and then the great thing was you always had to keep your head wet. After we got up in the desert, I think after about a month in the desert, there wasn't a topi left. don't know if there was anything official about it. We had our tin hats, of course, and nobody ever wore them. And we wore our fore and aft green side caps.
Did you get involved in any active operations in Sudan?
No. No.
There was nothing going on?
No, we practiced for it as we did in Bombay, but we never took part in anything at all.
What was the city of Khartoum like?
Rather bare. All sand, unless you really sort of got a patch and watered and watered and watered and watered. But just sand, wide, empty streets. I had a motor car. It wasn't mine, actually. The previous regiment, and I can't remember what it was, left a T-model Ford outside the mess and said, anybody can have this for £5. Well, George Listard bought it for £5 and got it going. And when he went home on leave, he left it with me. And it hadn't got a roof at all. It was just absolutely open with a steel steering wheel. So you had to wear gloves, whatever the weather, to drive the darn thing, because it was absolutely red hot. And so was the seat red hot, too. No hood. But it went over the country better than ordinary motor cars, because it was so light and very powerful. And it bounced over the sand like anything. Very useful.
What were your impressions of the native population?
Well, never came into any contact with them at all. As far as the shops were concerned, they seemed to be mostly staffed by Greeks. Amusements. Well, there was a cinema in the camp, and I think it changed every week, and that was a sort of the social occasion. Go to the cinema wearing a dinner jacket, of course, once a week. There was a hotel, and there was a club. And of course, flying boats were in the action in those days. They used to land on the Nile quite nearby, and you'd see people occasionally come in. Found people I knew actually stopping the night in Khartoum en route to India or back home. There was a zoo, was quite an attraction. There was a sort of Hungarian cabaret too, which one used to go to occasionally, which was pretty dismal. Khartoum was really rather primitive. You made your own amusements, such as this concert party I was telling you about, based on the band.
Did you see anything of the Sudan Defence Force?
Oh, yes. We used to play polo against them. And there were certainly a couple of my regiment who were attached to the Sudan Defence Force, but much further up down in the south, so we didn't see them, except when they were passing through.
Did you have anything to do with the